Nemoto presents scientific giants. James Clerk Maxwell, When Light Becomes an Equation. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 28 minutes. You're listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed Our Understanding of the World We Live In. Each episode stands beside one mind and follows a thread of curiosity until it ties to the world we inhabit. Today we climb a narrow stair in Cambridge, chalk dust soft underfoot, and step into a room where a length of copper wire lies coiled beside a galvanometer, where a glass prism rests next to a box of colored filters, and where a slate board carries a forest of symbols that look, at a distance, like a map of a country nobody has yet visited. The man who fills this room with his awkward grace is quiet, large-handed, shy with strangers, quick with friends. When he picks up the chalk, the marks he makes will become the grammar of light and radio, of motors and microphones, of the magnetic hush inside an MRI scanner, and the far rumble of a storm carried to a ship at sea. His name is James Clerk Maxwell. He will take Faraday's lines of force and give them equations, marry electricity to magnetism, calculate that the resulting wave runs at the speed of light, and then look up, astonished and satisfied, to say, "Light is that wave." He will lay the foundations of statistical mechanics, write about the stability of Saturn's rings and the mathematics of flyball governors, think about color until a ribbon leaps off a screen in the first durable color photograph, and then, with a twinkle, invent a demon to tease the second law of thermodynamics into revealing its statistical heart. He will die before 50. The house he built, the Cavendish Laboratory, will outlive him. The sentences he wrote on a slate will keep writing the world. Begin far from Cambridge, in a smaller house with damp stone at its foot. He is born in 1831 in Edinburgh, an only child, christened James, carrying the old family name Clerk that will sit uneasily between first and last as if it were a hinge. His mother, Frances, teaches him to look gently. His father, John, practical and affectionate, keeps an estate at Glenlair in Galloway and takes his boy along when fences need mending or a drain needs clearing. The child inspects puddles, pokes with a stick, notices the way light breaks in a thin film of soap. When he is not quite 14, he sends a paper to the Royal Society of Edinburgh about oval curves, how they can be made by strings and pins and traced with compasses. Too young to present it himself, the boy watches as the geologist James Forbes reads it for him. It is not the content that matters so much as the tone. See a shape, find a rule, draw it so that a stranger can make it again. He sits in classrooms in Edinburgh and then, in 1850, goes south to Cambridge. He matriculates first at Peterhouse and then moves to Trinity, drawn by teachers whose chalk he admires and friends whose talk he loves. He is a tall, solid man who runs cross-country for joy, writes light verse with a Scots lilt and humor, and, when the algebra grows thick, hums a psalm under his breath to keep his balance. He does not drink deeply of college games. He prefers a walk out past the meadows, a conversation that twists toward first principles, an evening with a prism and a candle. He sits the mathematical tripos and emerges as second wrangler, tied for first in the more searching Smith's prize, because the examiners can see the reach of his hand even when his handwriting betrays haste. He is not fussy about rank. He is fussy about truth. A teaching post takes him north as professor of natural philosophy at Marischal College in Aberdeen in 1856. The colleges merge, the chair vanishes, and he moves to London to King's College, where he will remain for 5 years in rooms always a little too small for the thoughts in them. He marries in 1858, Catherine Mary Dewar, the principal's daughter, a partner whose calm steadiness becomes the country he returns to each evening. They will have no children. Their companionship, by every account that survives, is a quiet goodness. Before the coils and chalk, a ring around a distant planet claims him. Saturn's rings are old as Galileo's telescope, but their nature is a riddle. Are they solid disks, liquid sheets, or something else entirely. The mathematics of stability has a way of turning a poet's question into a clerk's decision. Maxwell writes on the stability of the motion of Saturn's rings in 1859, a doctoral essay that calculates the consequences of symmetry and perturbation until only one answer survives. The rings cannot be solid, or they would break. They cannot be continuous fluid, or they would shear. They must be swarms of countless small bodies, each obeying gravity, each in its own orbit, a cohesion not of substance, but of law. The paper wins a prize from Cambridge. A century later, spacecraft will rush past and send back images of braided rings, gaps, eddies, shepherd moons, confirmations not of an oracle's vision, but of arithmetic done carefully enough to outlast distance. At King's, he turns toward color because the world is pale to those who do not study it. He reads Thomas Young and Hermann von Helmholtz on trichromacy, the idea that human color vision can mix all hues from three primaries, and decides to see whether a device can make a theory speak. He builds a color top mounted with paper discs whose colored sectors can be spun until the eye merges them into a single sensation. He measures matching functions, invents triangles of color where tints coordinates, make a location, and runs experiments with care enough to make taste into data. In 1861, at the Royal Institution in London, he carries out a public test that will become legend not because it is perfect. The slides are crude, the filters leaky, but because it is the first of its kind done with a showman's exactness by a mind that loves to verify. Three black and white photographs are taken of a tartan ribbon through red, green, and blue filters. Three magic lanterns project the images through the same colored glass onto a screen, aligned with fastidious patience until they overlay. The tartan leaps into color. People draw breath. The apparatus is clumsy and the reproduction incomplete. Still, the ribbon on the wall has been conjured from the sum of three limited pictures. In that triangle of primaries lies every pixel you have ever met. The man who showed it first is wearing a slightly rumpled coat and smiling a little to himself because the world is behaving again. Color is not the main song. It is a prelude that accustoms the ear to harmony. On another desk sits Faraday's legacy, a language without equations about lines of force, a stout refusal to speak of forces as if they were ropes tugging across emptiness, a faith that space is not nothing but something that can carry energy and shape. Faraday drew with filings. Maxwell will draw with calculus. He writes on Faraday's lines of force in 1855 to 56, and then on physical lines of force in 1861 to 62, building mechanical analogies that feel, to a modern eye, quaint, idle wheels in a fluid ether, vortices that carry strains and push neighboring wheels along. He does not confuse analogy with ontology. He is using pictures to arrive at equations, and when the pictures fall away, the equations will remain. The crux is this. The algebra that describes how electric charges pile up and leak away, how magnetic induction twines around a current, and how changing magnetism breeds electric fields must be consistent with itself, not merely with any one apparatus. Ampere's law in its older form, magnetic fields curl around currents, cannot alone account for what happens in a condenser, a capacitor, when a current charges the plates. Between the plates, there is no conduction current, and yet a changing electric field does the work of one. Maxwell adds a term, the displacement current, to complete the curl. That addition is a mercy to the algebra and a revelation to physics. In 1865, in A Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Field, he shows that the coupled equations for electric and magnetic fields, with that new term included, emit waves, self-sustaining ripples of field traveling through space at a speed determined by the electrical permittivity and magnetic permeability measured in laboratories. He calculates the speed. It matches the measured speed of light. With that line of chalk, the universe changes accent. Light, which had been a phenomenon with too many adjectives, sometimes wave, sometimes particle, sometimes ether's ripple, sometimes a corpuscular stream, becomes, in his voice, a part of electricity and magnetism. We can scarcely avoid the conclusion. He writes with Scottish caution that is only partly a mask for delight. That light consists in the transverse undulations of the same medium, which is the cause of electric and magnetic phenomena. We no longer speak of the medium. We learn to do without it. We still keep the conclusion. The straight lines a child draws from a star to her eye, the blue of the sky and the angle of a rainbow, a radio humming, your phone's antenna, a microwave warming last night's dew, a hospital's magnet reading water spins, a GPS correcting for relativity slippage. These are regions of one field, oscillations of one fabric. He writes the result large, not in a journal article, but in a book that sets a discipline's table for a century. A treatise on electricity and magnetism appears in 1873. It is dense, generous, and sometimes a little English with its reluctance to write down what it is doing. He uses minimal algebra and a maximal geometry that will soon give way to vector calculus in the hands of Heaviside and Gibbs. 33 years will pass before Einstein and Minkowski will give his field a space-time fit for its stride. Even so, the treatise has the trembling gravity of a book that knows what it is. Behind its pages lies an ethic. Theory and experiment must teach each other until habit becomes law. He derives boundary conditions and energy densities. He introduces the idea of stress carried by a field, pressures that push on matter, and even on the field itself. He gives students a way to think with lines drawn not only around rods and coils, but through space where nothing seems to live, and yet laws apply. He writes down 20 equations in 20 unknowns that summarize the relationships among electric field, magnetic field, charge, and current. The later simplified for equations, written in compact vector form, carry his name as if the work were tidy. It was not tidy. It was honest. He is not content to live in a single room of physics. Here is a man who, when hungry, makes a meal of a problem nearest to hand and eats only until the appetite shifts. He writes to William Thomson, later Lord Kelvin, about the thermodynamics of heat and work. He reads Boltzmann and pushes back and then pushes on. He asks whether temperature is an average kinetic energy of molecules and then builds a distribution to show how likely different speeds are. In 1860, in Illustrations of the Dynamical Theory of Gases, he gives the world the Maxwell distribution, a bell-shaped curve of speeds whose area can be colored into answer questions about collisions and diffusion, viscosity and conduction. He reasons that the form of the curve must be stable under collisions. Two molecules exchanging energy do not skew the population in a way that violates symmetry, and that it must depend on temperature in a way that preserves the independence of directions. From these demands, the exponential appears, not as an idol, but as a function that keeps its manners when poked. The result carries predictions. Gas viscosity, he says, should be independent of pressure in a wide range. It is. Diffusion rates should scale with the square root of temperature. They do. Noise, inevitable and everywhere, becomes a tool. Insensibility to details becomes a virtue rather than a vice. The second law of thermodynamics, which in a line sounds like doom, entropy increases, becomes in his hands statistical. Overwhelmingly likely, not metaphysically compulsory. To teach the difference, he invents a creature in 1867, a finite being that can, in imagination, sit at a tiny door between two gas chambers and, by letting fast molecules pass one way and slow the other, make a temperature difference without doing work. Maxwell's demon is not meant as a cudgel to break the second law. It is a tutor that forces us to see that information has thermodynamic weight and that in talking about the world, we must count not only the marbles in the box, but the right to sort them. He has an eye for small apparatus with large consequence. His dynamical top and cameos in mechanics are classroom pets. His Maxwell's discs for color mixing, flicked on a string, turn colored wedges into a blended hue so a student can believe with her eyes. He writes on governors in 1868, analyzing the feedback loop in a steam engine's centrifugal governor, showing mathematically how delay and gain together can make a machine hunt and oscillate or come gently to a set point. Control theory will borrow that essay as a grandfather of 100,000 thermostats quietly keeping rooms bearable on a winter night. None knows its ancestor's name. He gives others credit obsessively. A footnote becomes a small shrine to a craftsman or a friend who lent a piece of apparatus. He writes literature as if it were a conversation and experiments as if they were letters. His relation to Faraday's lines of force is a case study in how different styles can marry. Faraday, older by 40 years, is an artisan son of a blacksmith, allergic to algebra, ecstatic with apparatus, sure that space is full of something we can feel while a needle trembles. Maxwell, who as a boy learned to bind books and mend drains, arrives from Cambridge carrying methods of integration and elimination. He reads Faraday not as a mystic, but as a guide to a topography of forces that mathematics can measure. In a memorial essay later, with grief quiet in his pen, he will write that Faraday's method of conceiving field is able to take its place side by side with that of the mathematicians, and then he will spend more ink showing that they are not rivals, but hands on the same instrument. He does not mind controversy when it washes the dirt from a question. He draws the ire of those who want action at a distance to rule, without a medium, without a field. He refuses to insult them. He lays his diagrams beside theirs and says, "Try mine." He visits laboratories where demon hunting would be impolite. He prefers to show a galvanometer's twitch to an argument. He answers letters with patience and with jokes. He writes light verse that parodies his own solemn work. He carries Psalm 119 in his pocket as a tonic. Faith and work live without quarrel in him. He sees no violation in a world where law is expressive of order and order is expressive of an author whose habits are worth loving. He leaves London in 1865 and returns to Glenlair, cares for his father's house, mends fences, writes, thinks, walks. In 1871, Cambridge calls again with a post that will be remembered as much for the building that came with it as for the man who first filled the office. He becomes the inaugural Cavendish Professor of Physics. The Cavendish Laboratory will be born in a courtyard off Free School Lane, a domestic-looking red brick place with rooms that smell of oil and wood shavings and solder. Maxwell oversees the plans the architect William Fawcett draws. He wants light at benches, clean storage for apparatus, a lecture room where demonstrations can be seen and not only praised. He insists that students learn with their hands. Instruments and methods, he writes, are as essential to a laboratory as spectrum and balance. He scours the papers and notebooks of Henry Cavendish, the 18th century recluse who had done experiments in electricity with such accuracy that, when published under Maxwell's editorial hand, they make senior men in London blush. Cavendish had measured the inverse square law and the conductivity of solutions with a precision that would have made a modern committee proud. Maxwell writes an edition thick with notes that are little lectures in their own right, a tribute from one exact mind to another, who had worked in a different century, like a stranger in the wrong century. The laboratory becomes a habit, not a building. It begins to train the hands who will build the next piece of physics. Maxwell does not live to see Joseph John Thomson separate a beam and weigh the electron, nor to see Rutherford read a nucleus in a scattering pattern, nor to see Cavendish-trained minds draw wires into vacuum tubes and valves, nor to hear the whisper of a radio across the phone. He dies in 1879 at Glenlair of abdominal cancer, the same disease that killed his mother when he was a boy. He is 48. Those who loved him say that he faced the end as he faced errors in his work, with simplicity and a steady eye. Because we are telling a story for the ear, it helps to stop and listen to the sentences he leaves us that have nothing to do with equations and everything to do with habit. Thoroughness, he writes to a student, in little things, method and accuracy, and a facility in perception of geometrical relations. You can feel the Scot in it and the Christian and the man who tuned experiments like instruments until noise fell. He is frequently funny. When a friend proposes to use a metaphor too thin to hold a load, Maxwell says it is like driving nails with a razor. When a committee wants to save money on apparatus, he writes verses about the budget of paradoxes and laughs before others do so that they can join him without injury. He is better at kindness than at performance. When a friend's child is ill, he writes a note about coloring and light, a little lesson wrapped around a blessing, to occupy a parent terrified of helplessness. Let us bring three of his rooms together before we leave him. In the first, the slate carries the four field equations in the tidy vector form they later will learn to wear, the law that magnetic field lines do not begin or end but close on themselves, the law that electric field lines begin and end on charges, Faraday's fame, that a changing magnetic field produces an electric field, the completion of Ampere, that a changing electric field produces a magnetic field. He points at the terms with the end of the chalk. He draws a loop in the air and then a surface through which a field pierces, as if through a net. He imagines and asks you to imagine a region where nothing is happening except the changing of a field. He asks you to let space do the work. When you nod, he smiles, because a victory over picture habits is the hardest kind and the one that gives the most power. In the second room, a box of air is full of invisible things with mass and speed, and a door is manned by a tiny imaginary agent with quick eyes. The demon is not a gremlin to excuse magic. It is a teacher to force you to calculate what counts as work and what counts as information, and why knowledge empties a tank of chance as surely as a weight falls. 30 years later, Szilard and Landauer will do the arithmetic for demons. We still owe the demon its rope trick that knots entropy to knowledge. Maxwell intends no blasphemy against the second law. He means to change its tense from must to almost certainly must, and then to show how civilization is built in the thin spaces where almost leaves room for skill. In the third room, a tartan ribbon glows on a screen. Faded, imperfect, and yet unmistakable, its reds and greens and blues lifted by three lanterns into something an audience can trust. Maxwell has not given the world chemistry's recipes for dyes, nor physiology's precise pigments, nor the brain's code for red. He has given it a recipe for reproducing color that printers can use, painters can think with, engineers can feed to phosphors and LEDs and liquid crystals. When we look at a field of pixels and judge a sky to be accurate, we are reenacting in fancier glass his evening of filters and ribbons. He was not a saint, and science is worse when it trades truth for shrine. He trusted mechanical analogies farther than most modern readers would. He wrote, sometimes, as if a luminiferous ether must exist because his equations described something that, to his eye, deserved materiality. He did not live to fight out with experiment and logic the ether's dismissal. He is buried with his tenderness for a medium. He wrote with a candor that can slow readers who want a textbook sternness. His treatise rambles where a modern monograph would prune. He used mathematics that later workers would recast and streamline. None of this is fault. It is history doing its work through hands that are scrupulous rather than perfect. What changed because he chalked those curves? Faraday's fields, which had been a craftsman's ribbon and a philosopher's puzzle, became variables and equations that engineers could put into iron and copper. Light lost its antique otherness and became a wave in the same sea as the crackle that leaps from a rubbed rod and the tug that swings a compass needle. The second law shed fatalism and put on statistics, always softened to overwhelmingly likely, leaving scientists free to ask where exceptions live and what they would cost to harvest. When Einstein writes in 1905 that the laws of physics must be the same in all inertial frames and that light speed is the same for all observers, he is, in part, making peace between mechanics and Maxwell, the latter refusing to let the wave slow for anyone, the former insisting that velocities add. When Hertz later in the 1880s builds a spark gap apparatus that launches and catches electromagnetic waves in a laboratory, radio in embryo, the sound of the spark is a footnote to Maxwell's 1865 paper. When Oliver Heaviside recasts the treatise in crisp vectors, the England of telegraphs and transatlantic cables becomes a physics classroom when pointing writes down the vector that gives the direction of energy flow in a field. It is Maxwell's stress and energy he is tidying. The Cavendish will breed an empire of carefulness that runs wire through the 20th century's devices. The stone in Westminster Abbey that bears Maxwell's name is almost too small for all the rooms his thought furnished. If you want to walk out of this hour with a small device in your pocket that sums him, pick up a compass. Hold it near a wire-carrying current. Watch the needle tilt. Now imagine, if you can, an invisible ring curling around the wire, even when no iron is there to betray it. Imagine that if you break the circuit and charge a capacitor, a different kind of current, not of charges moving through metal but of a field changing in time, will make its own ring. Imagine the field storing energy and momentum, pushing on matter, slipping past wires and glass and vacuum. Imagine that if the field ripples at just the right rate, you'll call it red or blue or radio or X-ray, and that the differences among those names are of frequency and wavelength, not of species. When you can see that you have learned a little to see as Maxwell asked a century and a half of us to see. We leave him, not in the Abbey's marble stasis, but under a Galloway sky where rain stings and the grass gives a little under a boot. He is walking a fence line with a wire stapled to posts that carry, in their quiet way, the news of a field. He is thinking about the next lecture at the Cavendish. He will say something kind about Cavendish and something amused about Faraday and something slippery about displacement current that will make a student frown just long enough to learn. He will go home to a house where Catherine is reading and where dinner is plain and where, if he is not too tired, he will write rhyming couplets on the margin of a paper to keep his own severity from turning into pride. In a notebook nearby, a list of problems sits, half solved, each with a little cross where the unknowns have been boxed and labeled: viscosity, dielectric constant of gases, the leverage of governors, a better galvanometer, the last corrections to the treatise's figures, the orders for the new benches at the lab. He is, for a moment, content. The universe is still larger than his reach. It is not larger than his hope. You have been listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed Our Understanding of the World We Live In. Today we stood in a Cavendish classroom, a London lecture hall, and a Scottish field, and watched James Clerk Maxwell turn Faraday's lines into equations, equations into waves, and waves into everything from color on a screen to radio over a horizon, while teaching heat to speak statistics, governors to hold a set point, and a thought experiment to separate fate from likelihood. In our next episode, we will travel to St. Petersburg and a cold study with a wood stove and an unruly beard, where a chemist arranges 40-plus elements on cards, feels a pattern asking to be made public, and leaves blanks for the ones the world has not yet found. Dmitri Mendeleev, who will give matter its periodic table and prediction a seat at the lab bench.
P.